Good evening. The brother of George Floyd addresses Congress. The FBI comes to New York City to ask questions. And a former police detective speaks. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. In a voice crackling with anger and sadness, Felonious Floyd, whose brother George was murdered by police 2 weeks ago, challenged Congress to stop the pain and prevent his brother from becoming just another name on a growing list of victims of police violence. I'm here to ask you to make it stop, Floyd told the hushed hearing room.
The world knows him as George, but I called him Perry. Yesterday we laid him to rest. It was the hardest thing I ever had to do. I'm the big brother now, so it's my job to comfort my brothers and my sisters, Perry's kids, and everyone who loved him. And that's a lot of people. I have to be the strong one now because George is gone. And me being the big brother now is why I'm here today, to do what Perry always would have done, to take care of the family and others. I'm tired of pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to for your whole life, die begging for his mom. I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Stop the pain. Stop us from being tired. George called for help, and he was ignored. Please listen to the call I'm making to you now, to the calls of our family and the calls ringing out the streets across the world. People of all backgrounds, genders, and races have come together to demand change. Enough is enough. The people marching in the streets are telling you enough is enough by the leaders that in our country, the world needs the right thing. The people elected you to speak for them, to make positive change. George's name means something. You have the opportunity here today to make your names mean something too. I didn't get the chance to say goodbye to Perry while he was here. I was robbed of that. But I know he's looking down at us now. Perry, look up at what you did. Big brother, you changed the world. Thank you for everything, for taking care of us on earth, for taking care of us now. I hope you found mama and you can rest in peace with power. Thank you.
Felonious Floyd, brother of George Floyd, known to his family as Perry. House Judiciary Committee Chair Jerry Nadler gaveled the session in a room marked by lawmakers and witnesses wearing masks against the COVID-19 outbreak. Democrats are reviewing changes in police methods after mass protests in the wake of Floyd's killing. Since the video of George Floyd begging for breath as a Minneapolis police officer, since charged with murder, kneeled on his neck, millions have spilled into the streets in protest. President Trump has repeatedly blamed anarchists, a non-existent group that's more a meme called Antifa, or sundry conspiracy theories from the dark web for the unrest. Last week, after thousands surrounded the White House, forcing Trump into a basement bunker, the president and his attorney general ordered an attack on peaceful protesters. The purpose apparently was a photo op at a nearby church, where Trump held a Bible aloft as tear gas grenades flew in the surrounding streets. The senior pastor of Plymouth United Church of Christ is Reverend Graylin Hagler. He spoke with WBAI about the incident and the sermon he gave a few days later.
Clearly, clergy have reacted all over the city negatively to that appearance, that sideshow of holding up a Bible as a declaration really of war and a declaration of taking away people's freedom of speech, people's right to assembly, people's right to protest. And it was all obviously a signal to his right-wing base, his right-wing evangelical base. He's made no bones about not being a president for any of us except for that little narrow constituency that listens to every word he has to say.
He gave a speech, and in that speech, he using religion as a declaration of war against protesting people.
is used very often by fascists because there is not just one biblical tradition that exists in the world. One is always liberative and another one is always empire. Protects the empire, secures the empire, takes land for the empire, enslaves for the empire. And so we're clear that there's not just one type of faith perspective, but there are clearly two. One is liberative and one is fascist.
What was the reaction, how people you've talked to have reacted to what happened there?
Most of the preachers I've talked to, most black, some Jewish, some imams, really thought it was a blasphemous use of scripture. It was a blasphemous use. It was calculated. It was something that made a mockery of the Bible. And as most people said he held up the Bible, but they're quite confident he's never opened up the Bible. And he may have held it up, but he surely doesn't have it in his heart.
Are we going to see more of this, do you think, this polarization in America where the Bible means one thing to racists and another thing to people of faith?
Of course we're going to see more of this because it's always existed. Right now it is a struggle against those of us who believe in justice and in right relationships and treating each other fairly in a loving God versus those who are really aligned with power and fascism and an interpretation of God that has nothing to do with mercy and has nothing to do with the care for humanity.
What was the title of your sermon and what was the response? What were you trying to say in your sermon yesterday?
My sermon title was Let There Be Light. And I basically said that it's a declaration that God makes in Genesis, and then it says, and there was light. And the issue is I pointed out that the light comes into the midst of the darkness all the time. And the light right now, the people in the street who are marching, they are bearers of the light. They are reminding the country that they're to come out of the darkness. They're, in fact, commanding it like it is commanded in Genesis. Let there be light. You make the commandment, and then you proceed to bring forth the light. You know, Roger Goodell, and I mentioned this in the sermon, talks about he was wrong. And I hope that he has seen the light, but we'll see. But on the other hand, Dan Snyder is one of the biggest supporters of Trump. And I raised in the sermon, all of you who buy those football team tickets and you buy all that merchandise from somebody who is actually supporting your own oppression.
Reverend Graylin Hagler is senior pastor of Plymouth United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. And in New York City, demonstrations against police violence continue. The protests are occurring all over the city. Thousands have gathered in Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Manhattan to march for hours at a time. WBAI spoke with a protester on Manhattan's east side.
I'm Maria. I think a lot of the reason I'm here today is because of the memory of my grandparents growing up in the South during Jim Crow, and my father also growing up at that time has inspired me. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of breath right now because I've been walking so much. Has inspired me to come out here because I've heard stories of what they've gone through and to see that nothing really has changed and that we've been led to believe that things have changed. But racism hasn't really changed. It's just evolved to fit the times. Prejudice and racism and anti-blackness doesn't evolve in a linear track. It just morphs and conforms to the current times we're living in. And in that way, I think police brutality is a manifestation of that anti-blackness and that racism that is embedded so heavily into the American consciousness. So I'm here to defend my right to live, my grandparents' right to live, and all black people's right to live.
More than 2,000 New Yorkers have been arrested and detained for as much as 48 hours, mostly for curfew violations since the killing of George Floyd. Many held in abysmal conditions without food, water, or face masks against the coronavirus. But according to lawyers, that hasn't stopped police and FBI agents from attempting to interrogate some. Questions include, what social media accounts do you follow? What do you know about Antifa? How did you hear about the protest? Who is in charge of the protests, and many others. Civil rights attorney Martin Stolar has been representing many arrested for curfew violations, a Class B felony. He says an arrested person has every right to refuse to answer these kind of questions.
The rules say that they can ask questions about people's politics and religion and First Amendment stuff if they have permission. That is, if they can make a case that say there's some kind of underlying criminal conduct which permits us to answer to ask questions of this nature. That's something that's called an investigation statement has to be filed by them in order to do this. And it has to be approved by the Handshoe Committee, which is an internal police department committee that operates with some high-level legal people and an outside civilian representative. If there was an authorized investigation to ask these kinds of questions, then they're legal. But I can't conceive of any circumstance under which there was such an authorized investigation. So the question has been put to the city to say, here's the questions that were asked. How come? Why are you doing this?
And do they respond?
The response that we got from the Peter Farrell, who is the appropriate representative of the city law department, who's been on this case for many years, said, thank you very much. We're looking into it. We'll get back to you.
Do you think that you're going to have to follow other legal pathways to deal with this?
We may. I trust that when Peter says he'll get back to us, he will, and the police department will give us some kind of response. I don't know what it will be. It could be this was an authorized investigation. It could be this didn't take place. It could be it was a mistake. I'd like some kind of answer. I mean, there are remedies. If we don't get satisfaction from this, then our next step is to write an official cure letter, which is directed to Corporation Counsel. And if we don't get a cure, if there's a violation of the guidelines that we cannot fix before going to court, then we go back to the judge.
So they mentioned Antifa a lot, that this is a real threat, that there's radicals, anarchists out there who are plotting to kill the police. Is that adequate?
Well, most of the Antifa questions, to the extent they were reported to me, came from FBI agents, not from NYPD intelligence officers.
Were there FBI agents involved in these questionings?
Absolutely. There were a bunch of people at a precinct in Brooklyn who were held in a cell waiting to have their summonses written because they'd been arrested on curfew violations. And they were pulled out of the cell one by one and questioned by two men. One identified himself as an FBI, and the other identified himself as a NYPD intelligence guy.
What are your rights? These are people who have been arrested. They haven't...
Most of the curfew violations have been charged in a summons, which is returnable in criminal court, summons court, charging them with the offense of curfew violation, which is, at the moment, a Class B misdemeanor.
Wow, that's pretty
that's
serious.
A crime. Well, it's a crime. You know, it's a crime. You could get 90 days. I have a suspicion. Look, I've been doing protest cases for years. You know, I have a feeling that a lot of these cases are going to be dropped by the city. They can't prosecute all these people. They'd be idiots to do so. But at the moment, they have open criminal cases that have to be dealt with in court.
What are your rights if you're arrested at a protest, curfew violation, or anything else and held? I mean, do you have to answer these questions? And as a lawyer...
Absolutely not. The only question you have to answer when you're arrested is basically pedigree information, name, address, date of birth. But otherwise, you keep your mouth shut. That's the advice I gave everybody. Whether they're arrested for murder or arrested for disorderly conduct, you keep your mouth shut. You're under no obligation whatsoever to answer any questions beyond personal pedigree.
Have people been answering questions? Are people not well-versed in their rights?
When they figured out what was going on, told the agents to forget about it. For example, one of the witnesses reported to me that they were standing in a line at 120 Skemmerhorn, which is the Brooklyn Central booking, and one guy was pulled out. He went over. They took him over. He talked to some guy in plain clothes. Then he comes back into line, and he reports to the other people. The guy said he was an FBI agent. He asked me about Antifa. I told him to get fucked. There's a question about Antifa from an FBI agent, which I think is reliable hearsay. And the guy told him, forget about it. I'm not answering your questions, which is absolutely his right. He's under no obligation to do so, nor is anybody else.
Do you think there's some sort of, just as a last question, any COINTELPRO or any sort of like orders coming from Attorney General Barr or something like that to look for people?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's certainly not, that doesn't control New York City. He doesn't control the New York City Police Department. They have their own massive intelligence agency. I call the Intelligence Bureau. But Barr has been talking about Antifa as the, you know, the bugaboo. They're the ones who started all these protests. You know, it's outside agitators and it's the Antifa people. And Barr's up there talking about it. I can assure you that the FBI responds to that.
Civil rights attorney Martin Stolar He's been defending people arrested in protests in New York City since 1970, thousands of them. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Both houses of the New York State Legislature have passed a bill to repeal New York Civil Rights Law Section 50A, which has shielded police disciplinary records from the public for 44 years. Governor Andrew Cuomo has said he would sign any bill the legislature passed on 50A reform, and the bill is written to take effect immediately. The law requires cops to turn over the disciplinary records of police officers. A lecturer at law at Columbia University, Alexis Hoag, says 50A has been used to shield the records of violent cops from families of the victims of police abuse.
I was not surprised at what happened in Minneapolis. I think it really was a snapshot where we are in this country, that you had a police officer acting with impunity. I think what was most disturbing, perhaps for viewers, myself included, of that video, was that that officer was aware that he was being filmed. And that did not alter his conduct at all. And I think it speaks to the fact that police officers are very rarely held accountable for their misconduct and their lethal misconduct.
Is this something new that's getting worse?
Qualified immunity as a defense in a civil lawsuit against law enforcement was judicially created by the Supreme Court in 1982, and it shields police from accountability. In New York City, for instance, there is a Civil Code 50A, which shrouds police personnel files from the public. And that was passed, I believe, in the mid-1970s. So this idea of lack of accountability is definitely a recent phenomenon. I don't know that it was necessarily passed in reaction to protests, but the outcome of it today has been that if you are an individual who has been violated, your constitutional rights have been violated by the police, or you are a surviving family member of someone whose rights were violated, you cannot actually access the very information that would be most helpful for a jury to consider when determining whether or not this person should be held civilly or criminally liable. In New York City, there were some NYPD officials who actually covered their badge numbers and identification. And so even if something were to occur, which we know did based on the video footage captured, that individual wouldn't even be able to document who the police officer was.
Watching just moments ago an interview on CNN and protest person who was saying that she cries no tears if middle class white America fears crime because they're just going to get a taste of what black America has found.
I don't necessarily disagree with that protester. I think a number of things have to happen. Over the weekend, legislatures and members of the Senate, Democrats, drafted a Justice in Policing Act 2020. My understanding is that it would require a national database so that we could actually keep track of police misconduct. Who are the bad actors in the system? Because right now you can transfer from one department to another and your personnel file, which would contain police misconduct complaints, wouldn't travel with you. It would actually be to help collect data on use of force, which again does not currently happen. It would alter qualified immunity as an available means of defense in a civil lawsuit. It would end no-knock warrants, which is how we ended up police murdering Breonna Taylor in her own home. It would require de-escalation tactics. These are immediate, quick reforms. However, what I argue is that policing as we know it needs to be completely dismantled. The very idea of policing communities needs to change. Right now, the police see themselves as at war with communities. The very idea that police swoop into communities with guns drawn and an assumption of equating black people with dangerousness, black people with criminality, acting first, thinking second, that is what needs to end.
Alexis Hoag is a lecturer at law at Columbia University. As the call to defund police grows throughout the United States, some cops and former cops have been stepping forward. Detective Debbie Ramsey is a retired narcotics detective, formerly with the Baltimore Police Department. She says racism has always been a key ingredient in policing, and it's time for change.
I am all for a new model. The latest slogan is defund the police. I am for that 100% as a former Baltimore City police detective and also a detective in the Internal Investigation Division, where I investigate officers for wrongdoing, misconduct, and brutality. So I'm coming from inside of that realm of thinking. We didn't get like this overnight. It's baked in the cake to control people. Uniform patrol. I was in uniform patrol. Think about that last word, patrol. It pops up again. What does patrol? It brings up an image of patrolling someone. And when you have communities that are targeted, we're patrolling those communities.
How come since Freddie Gray and Michael Brown and the things that happened a few years ago, nothing has changed till now? All of a sudden, everybody wants to change everything. What changed? What happened?
When I was on the police department, I knew full well what I was getting into. I knew I was going to a white male dominant profession. I knew that. But guess what? They also knew what they were getting. A black woman who was someone's mother, someone's sister, someone's aunt. Okay? And that's how I police. So that's a two-way street. So it's nothing overnight. Maybe for others who have not been targeted, who have not been subjected to police overreaching their authority, it may seem like that, but we live with this moment by moment. It has not stopped. We have flashpoints and tipping points where it is highlighted. Even for myself as a police officer, I was not exempt. When my son started, when he became of driving age, I'm in a police uniform, and I had to explain to him what he needs to do when he's stopped by the doggone police. And I am the police. But the reality is, I know my son is black, I'm black, and I've seen some things. I've seen how officers operate. I see how people's constitutional rights were violated. I have witnessed officers doing search and seizures, stopping frisk illegal. You know what my sergeant did? Absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. If Baltimore City had invested the same amount of money in youth programs, out-of-school time programs, we would not have the violence that we are experiencing, and we would have more people working. I work with young people every day, and when they graduate from high school, where do they go from here? They are at a loss for the most part. So I would like for our city to take a look at where we're putting our money, because a budget, as President Obama said, is a more reflection of where we are as a people. When we put a half a billion into a police department that is under Department of Justice as a consent decree that says, in essence, yeah, Baltimore City Police Department, you violate people's constitutional rights way too much. That's what that is. So why would we put a half a billion dollar there? Do you know how much money goes into youth programs? No. This city voted on a referendum for $12 million. Not $1 has been spent. So that's what I would like to leave with. Put your money where we know that we're going to reap dividends down the road.
Detective Debbie Ramsey is a retired narcotics detective, formerly with the Baltimore Police Department. One of the targets of police violence as the protests jumped off in the wake of the killing of George Floyd were members of the media, both citizen reporters and professional journalists. According to the Freedom of the Press Foundation, there have been hundreds of incidents targeting the media, 80% involve police. The executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation is Trevor Tim.
What we've seen over the past 10 days has been absolutely unprecedented. It's really gone to a new level. Just to give you an idea, at Freedom of the Press Foundation, we run a project called the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, where we actually track press freedom violations in the U.S. And in all of 2019, we documented 150 press freedom violations. And in the past 10 days, we are investigated 330 of them.
Because President Trump has been repeatedly lambasting the media as fake news and calling for this kind of behavior.
Trump's comments have added fuel to the fire. There's no doubt about that. But it's a much more systemic issue than just President Trump. Like I had mentioned, you know, this had been going on in Ferguson in 2014 under the Obama administration. And there was another slew of arrests during the Occupy protests in 2011. And it's really been a failure on federal level, but also the state and local levels who control police departments and have the ability to protect journalists from these types of authoritarian actions, but really haven't stepped up to the plate in years past. Thankfully, there's been an incredible amount of attention on all of these attacks this past week, and we are hopeful that things will soon change.
Is it because journalists report things that are uncomfortable to the ruling class?
It certainly can be part of it. Think about all of these police brutality videos that we've just seen from the protest, let alone all of the George Floyd video and the countless other videos we've seen of police killing innocent black men in the past. But just in the past week, a lot of the videos of police brutality have been caught on camera by journalists, sometimes live on national television. The police obviously don't want a spotlight on this behavior. And I think if they think that they can stop it from the source, they can keep journalists from recording and documenting these incidences, then it won't have as big of an effect. We've seen how the American public needs video evidence to combat police lies, and it's incredibly important for them to do so, not just because it's enshrined in our Constitution, but because that's the only way that police are ever held accountable.
Is the rise of the citizen journalist, the person who videos, because some of the things we've seen, including the George Floyd killing, were brought to the attention by basically a child, a teenager who happened to be there with a cell phone.
It's the combination of those citizen journalism videos with the ability of news organizations to go out and do additional reporting based on those videos and amplify those videos is what is causing police to be held accountable for really the first time. It is a dangerous world out there for journalists right now, but it's even more dangerous for the protester who may just pull out his phone and witness something, and it's the first time they've ever recorded anything for public consumption. We've seen those people retaliated against over the past several years, too.
Where do we go from here?
It's hard to imagine this getting much worse. Like I said, there's about double the amount of press freedom violations in the past 10 days that we've seen in the entire year of 2019. News organizations are organizing against the brutality against their own industry. And it's the same thing we've seen around police brutality with all of the protests around the country that are starting to show real results, even in just the last couple of days. So I would just encourage people to stay aware, to keep sharing these videos, to contact your representative to make your voice heard.
Trevor Timm is executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And finally, New York State Attorney General Letitia James announced today the appointment of two special advisors to assist her investigation into recent interactions between the NYPD and the public. The two special advisors are Loretta Lynch, a former United States Attorney General, and Barry Friedman, a law professor at New York University and an expert in constitutional law. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.